Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Route, to the program where we gather every day at this time. Well, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between rural and urban America. Dr. Ted Fogarty has done a lot of good things for us through the years and joining us on the air today, he might have topped it all. It might be the topping on the ice cream. Dr. Molly James joining us from St. Louis. A friend of Dr. Fogarty's. How are you, Molly?
Hi, good morning. I'm great. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I shouldn't go so far as to say that you're a friend of Ted's because some people just don't want to be associated with him. So I didn't mean to put words in your mouth.
No, he's a good guy and he's changed the direction of my family's life. So we're grateful for him.
Dr. James is a doctor, obviously. ICU doctor, or should we say former ICU doctor in the greater St. Louis area. First of all, how long have you been practicing medicine?
About 10 years.
You think you'll ever get it right and stop practicing? I'm always humored, but practicing veterinary care, practicing medicine. When will you get it right?
You know, I don't think you ever get to that point because you always got to learn more. So it's always a practice and a learning endeavor.
And I've already discovered that you're from rural Iowa. We share some common ground in that regard.
Yeah, I'm from southern Iowa. Sheraton is my hometown. We always joke that I'm related to Jesse James, so watch your wallets when I'm around. You never know what will happen.
So that's a true story? You're related to Jesse James?
And we're also related to the younger brothers on the other side of the gang. So, yeah. It's in the genes.
That's funny. So, well, you know, actually, it's going to be really funny by the time we get done with this conversation. I'm going to write this down so I can bring it back around because I kind of have a feeling where we're going to go and the motivation behind Jesse James and Molly James might actually be more similar than we realize. Why did you choose medicine? Why did you choose to be a doctor?
It's just a calling. I can't even explain it. I was in pharmacy school, ironically, and was going to do the PharmD JD program. And one day I just realized that's not what I wanted to do. I got accepted to medical school after 2 years of college in an early enrollment program. And that was it.
And now you've been practicing 10 years.
Yes.
How did you end up in the St. Louis area?
So I'm actually a general surgeon by training. So I did general surgery and a critical care fellowship. I did a year of research. And I came here because of a job. I worked at the virtual ICU, and there's a large center here in St. Louis, and so I moved down basically to work here.
And I think everybody knows, but ICU doctor, what exactly does that mean?
So I'm an intensivist or critical care. So if a patient's admitted to the ICU, you know, those are the sickest patients in the hospital. They're on the ventilator, they're, you know, multi-system organ failure, severe infections, low blood pressure, cardiac issues that require intensive monitoring. So the sickest of the sick.
How long have ventilators been in use?
That's a great question. And I don't know, long before my time, but somewhere in the 1900s, they were developed and evolved into something we could use practically.
I actually never thought about that, Molly, until this moment. I want to go find the history behind that. I know that you have a family situation. I'll just share it with you, with mine as well. On September 15th, we lost my 45-year-old brother who simply waited too long to get a hold of me or his mother and get Dr. Fogarty involved. They put him in the hospital and I absolutely watched what happened, and remdesivir is what actually took his life, although they blame it to be COVID. But we went through that heart and lung machine. We went through the ventilator, and my regret now is not going to the hospital. I'm told I wouldn't have done anything but get arrested. But that was my experience in the family with COVID-related activities. What is your just across the board, what's going on with COVID in your mind?
Yeah. So just for a little background for your listeners, last April, Governor Cuomo asked for help. So I was one of the doctors who responded to New York City as a volunteer in the ICU. Mm-hmm. So what I've been doing the last year is going between St. Louis and ICU So I've basically been working in a peak of the pandemic for most of the last year and a half until recently. So I've probably seen around 2,000 critically ill COVID patients. So I've been down that road with a lot of patients. And I think the big miss is this. First of all, I think the doctors in the hospital are trying their best and they want their best for their patients. I do believe that. I believe there's a big gap right now between what's being done and what should be done, but they want the best for their patients and they believe they're doing the right thing. Here's the big miss. Is there's two phases to this illness. There's the viral phase, which is the first 5 to 7 days. That's when people get upper respiratory stuff, right? A cough, a cold, a sore throat, they're tired and achy. Nobody's really going to the hospital at that point, right? Mm-hmm. So they're going to the point after between day seven and 14, about 20% of people or more will flip into this cytokine storm, this massive inflammatory response. This is where patients get in trouble. So it's obvious why an antiviral wouldn't work for a patient who's not in the viral phase. They're in the inflammatory phase, which is why we started seeing a little bit better outcomes when we added steroids and blood thinners, right? Because this is an inflammatory problem and a clotting problem. And we started seeing things improve a little bit in some patients.
You just described exactly what happened to my brother.
Yeah. I mean, the pattern is classic.
Because, I mean, we're looser German, and I would have been the same way had it not been for my time spent with Dr. Fogarty and Dr. Brad Meyer. But his thought process was, I'm just going to stay here on the couch and wait it out.
So there's kind of a double disincentive to go right now, right? Which is people who choose not to get vaccinated tend to believe... They tend to believe in early treatment if they can find it.
Right.
But also, if you choose not to get vaccinated, you kind of know the story at the hospital. You know, I hear countless patients telling me I was bullied, I was harassed, they were rude to me. They told me I should have just gotten vaccinated and I wouldn't have COVID, which isn't true. And so people who choose that route, now it compounds the problem because now they're very hesitant to go to the hospital. And so by the time they get to the hospital, they're even later in the disease process and there's even less of a chance to help them.
As a person who has, you will understand this, some people would laugh at me, but I've personally taken care of 1 million animals in my lifetime, mostly pigs, but cattle and goats, but over 1 million animals. I'm 55 years old. And the first thing that Dad teaches you as a stockman is that if you catch an animal that is sick immediately, you can turn it around. If you wait too long, it's going to be chronic and you're going to have a problem. And what you just described is exactly that. People are waiting too long and then it's a problem.
Well, and I've had this discussion, you know, being in the ICU, I was one of the people, right? I was on the inside. Mm-hmm. And when I learned about ivermectin and some of these other treatment options, I started talking to the doctors, right? And saying, hey, I don't think we've got this right. There's this new thing we should be trying. And, you know, I met a lot of resistance with that. And they said, well, you know, it's not FDA approved and it's not NIH approved. And the CDC says not to do that. But the CDC, their recommendation for early treatment is wait till you can't breathe and go to the hospital. So their treatment protocol that they recommend is so wrong. And so you can't stand behind that. You can't use that as justification for what's going on. Imagine you had that treatment option with other or that recommendation with other things. If somebody was at home having a heart attack and having chest pain, you don't tell them wait it out at home until you pass out and then come in. You know, when somebody's in heart failure, don't say, well, if you gain 10 pounds, stay home. But if you get to 25 and you can't breathe, come on in. You know, just like you said, everything is focused on early treatment across disease process. So why is COVID different? I think that's a big question that the people who are making policies need to answer and be held accountable for.
Do you have the answer for that yet?
I think you have to ask what the motives are. What are the mm-hmm. motives of the people in that position? Because, you know, I wanted to get into early treatment. And if I know some of the data on that, you can be certain they know. And so they should be held accountable to be recommending the most effective treatment for our citizens. That's their job.
I have a friend whose husband was had these exact symptoms we're talking about. They went to a hospital. He tested positive for COVID. They sent him home and said, wait 7 days. We can't have you come in the hospital now. His wife knew, she's a farm lady. She knew that this would be the worst thing possible. She had researched everything she could find on the web about what to do, what you just described. She went to the barn, got everything from the barn that she needed, and her husband 7 days later was just about perfect. Mm-hmm. And then he went to the doctor, went back to the hospital, and they're like, oh, wow, you're really good. Well, she treated him like an animal. Like we would, animals are getting treated better than people. That's the problem. Dr. Molly James, my guest. I'm the one, by the way, not the doctor who's comparing people to animals. She's just right here. Will give us the facts when we return with more. Roll Route, protect the harvest, making it possible for people to empower themselves to fight for property rights. Get more details about what Protect the Harvest is doing across the board and can do for you at protecttheharvest.com. We're back with more Dr. Molly James after this. You just pretend I'm a bull and you lead me where we need to be, right?
Fair enough.
3, 2, 1. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Luce, alongside Dr. Molly James, joining us from St. Louis, the greater St. Louis area, not St. Louis itself. I heard you say ICU, former ICU doctor. Are you in the ICU today?
I'm not. So as I mentioned before, I had volunteered in New York. I took a job in New York. So I was working in three different positions throughout the pandemic, 16, 18-hour days. I lost privileges in New York because I didn't have the vaccine by the end of September. So that was the last time I was out there. And the two jobs in St. Louis, one of them denied my religious exemption, which isn't really what they're supposed to do. I'm not asking for approval. I'm telling them I have an exemption. Mm-hmm. So I resigned from that position, and the other position actually approved my religious exemption, but then they came out with discriminatory policies that basically said, if you're unvaccinated, you must test weekly, which itself causes financial issues for people who have to do that, because if you test positive without symptoms, you're out of work for 10 days. So I declined testing, and I said, it's not a public health issue. There's no public health outcome tied to that. If you want to test everybody, I'll look at that. But I'm not truly immune. I pose almost no danger to anybody. I should be in the category with the least restrictions. And kind of the icing on the cake for me, Trent, was one day, it was busy day in the ICU. We had more patients than beds, and we were hustling. I took 10 minutes to eat in the break room. And my medical director, who's a physician, texted me and said, Molly, I noticed you're in the break room without a mask on with a vaccinated person, and that's not allowed. And I just had this flashback to the 1950s and 60s, and I feel like our country's going the wrong direction when we have that kind of nonsense.
Yeah. You know, what troubles me more than anything is that there just seems to be so many people comply and go along with it and not step back and take a look at the bigger picture, which obviously you did.
Yeah. And, you know, that doesn't surprise me, because I've been in these situations before where standing up for the right thing has cost me a job. And mm-hmm. what I've found is people will support you until their pocketbook is in jeopardy. And then you test their will. And there's a lot of noise right now. There's a lot of people saying a lot of things and scaring people in different directions regarding the vaccines, regarding early treatment and what you can and can't do as a physician. There's a lot of noise, and a lot of it doesn't have any legal bearing and can be challenged legally, but that's not happening because so many people are complying. So once you comply, you're asking for more of what you're getting.
I've been very perplexed. I have had, thanks to my relationship with Dr. Fogarty, I have had several people contact me, and I convey to them what he has shared with me in terms of what they should do early on. When they get COVID and they know that they have it. And I have to say that it's been 100% success story. I just wish Troy would have called me, but that's beside the point. And yet, after they have successfully gotten past all the symptoms, everything is fine, they still feel compelled to go talk to a doctor who may give them the wrong information. I'm so perplexed at how we're creatures of habit, And even though we know we're going to get the wrong information from folks from the NHI guidelines or whatever's causing that, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But humans are creatures of habit and continue to do what we've always done, no matter what they know.
Yeah. And my general thought right now regarding my colleague physicians, and I've never said this, you know, ever before in my career, if your doctor didn't bother to learn how to treat COVID, the most impactful medical event of our lifetimes, if they don't know how to treat that and they say there isn't anything I can do, how much do you think they know about other things they're treating? How much effort do you think they gave to make sure they're doing the right thing for other things? I think this is just the canary in the coal mine as to what they're doing and how they're practicing medicine.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So let's pretend that I am that early patient. I decided that I got some things that are going on. Dr. James, what should I do? What is the early recognition and how do I respond?
So first of all, for anybody listening, I would highly recommend that you get in touch with somebody before you need them. Just be prepared because I'm very concerned going into winter, what's going to happen. And I know in my own clinic, it takes a week or two to get in. And then it takes about a couple, 3 days to get the medications at the very best. So I would recommend being prepared ahead of time. That's the best strategy. And we offer those consultations. We prescribe the meds, we have them filled, and we ask our patients to treat at the first sign of symptoms. So for patients who don't do that and find themselves sick, number one, do not rely on a test. If you're symptomatic right now with an upper respiratory, it is COVID until proven otherwise. So get in with a doctor who offers early treatment. There are places, America's Frontline Doctors. I work with Dr. Ben Marble with myfreedoctor.com for people whose budget that may fit better. That's an online app-based medical service, and it's based on donations. You don't have to donate. You can get care for free if you need to. So when patients come in sick, there's a multi-drug regimen that I use, and I pull from different protocols. So the FLCCC, or the Frontline Critical Care Consortium, is one of the places. They're critical care doctors. Basically, they've done the research, they've looked at all the medications, and they've compiled guidelines. So they have the iMask protocol for prevention and early treatment, and they have the Math Plus protocol for inpatient treatment. So if I saw you today as a patient, I would review your medical history, obviously, and make sure there aren't any drug interactions, and I personalize it. But ivermectin is one of the key drugs. Ivermectin has, I think there's 20 mechanisms of action that they've identified, which is why it's helpful early, middle of the stream, and even late. It even helps with post-injection complications and things like that. So ivermectin is the key. I use hydroxychloroquine. I use an antibiotic, either doxycycline or azithromycin, and I generally throw fenofibrate in there up front. It's a cholesterol medication that reduces inflammation in the lungs. A lot of patients are taking statin drugs, cholesterol, like Lipitor. So if they're on that, we may or may not add the fenofibrate. But that's kind of where I start with treatment.
Hmm. That's all basic common sense. It makes total sense. And that's really all medicine is supposed to be, right? Basic common sense.
Well, and you would think common sense would say if there's doctors out there that have effectively treated thousands of patients successfully and none have gone to the hospital, we would want to know what they're doing. And that would be the top of the guidelines. There currently are no doctors at the national level who have treated patients making decisions. So there's a huge disconnect.
Yeah, well, that in itself should scare the people who are relying on doctors for advice if they're listening to somebody who's never actually treated someone in this position. I got this burning question that I just keep thinking of, and I don't go find the answer. Maybe you can give me the answer. You are on the, we'll call it the more affluent side of St. Louis. If you go on the east side of St. Louis, you have poverty, you have homelessness, you have things going on that's a topic for another day. But what I want to know is, why are we not seeing the pandemic in the poor communities across the country as we are in the affluent communities?
That's a great question, and I don't necessarily have an answer to that. I think at the beginning in New York, they were seeing homeless people in the subways and finding people. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard much about that, though, since the very, very peak last March and April. So I don't have a good reason for that, because all of the things we talk about to prevent it are good hygiene, right? Wash your hands, isolate when you're sick. So I don't have an answer for that.
Want my theory?
Yeah.
The people getting jabbed are spreading the virus, and the folks in the poorer communities haven't been jabbed, so consequently they're not being affected.
Yeah, I think that's worth looking into. Definitely, we know last year kids in school were getting sick, mildly ill, but they didn't bring it home. And this year, I definitely saw it from the minute kids went back to school. They would get a little sick, but they would bring it home, and mom and dad and the whole household would get sick. So there's definitely a change from 2020 to 2021 in what's happening.
And we would just theorize that that could be tied to a jab.
I would highly theorize that. Unfortunately, patients have been told that if you get the vaccine, you won't get COVID. It's 95% effective for getting it and spreading it. And we know now that's not true. Best case, it may be 40%. So patients, everybody, I think everybody at this point is going to get COVID. They're going to get COVID, and they're going to arrive at natural immunity. It's just, do they do that through a vaccine first and by the risk of the vaccine, or do they do that without the vaccine risk?
Dr. Molly James, my guest, we are halfway through already. I want to talk about another doctor who joins me on the air regularly, Dr. Nathan Bryan. Do you know Dr. Bryan, Molly?
I don't.
I need to make this connection. He is the global authority on nitric oxide and how nitrates are key to immune and your overall health. Now, this is not tied to COVID, because I've been taking a nitric oxide supplement, thanks to Dr. Nathan Bryan, for the last 18 years. And he is proof in the pudding that he can maintain a healthy lifestyle hanging with people that have COVID, because he is very well versed on and up to speed on taking his nitric oxide. You can do the same. NO2U.com. NO2U.com. Put Trent in the coupon code. You get a 10% discount and free shipping. Back with the second half. We'll roll out after this. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Trent Luce alongside Dr. Molly James, joining us from the west side of St. Louis. We're coming up with some research projects that you and I are going to have to work on. You know that, right?
Right. As life, more questions than answers sometimes.
But what we are both convinced of, you kind of said this without saying it directly, the future of medicine has changed forever.
100%. The divide in medicine right now is permanent and irreversible, because the emotion that's tied to it and the resentment between the sides, and the sides are this. The sides are the critical thinkers who are offering early treatment and believe there's a better way, versus the side that's said, the government tells me the best protocol and I'm going to do that. And I'm going to follow what they tell me to do, and I'm not going to step out of my lane. So that's irreversible.
And when the consumer, it's always a supply and demand scenario. When enough of the people become critical thinkers themselves, they're going to stop going to the establishment and seek true medical advice, which is exactly what you're doing.
Yes. And here, the funny thing, I'm from a farm community. They were treating themselves with ivermectin long before I knew about it. And I kind of joked and said, why didn't you tell me about this sooner? It's truly the magic bullet for COVID, I believe. At least the first magic bullet.
Have you explored why that's the case?
Yeah. There's a lot of mechanisms of action, like I talked about. So one of them is that it interrupts the spike protein engaging with the ACE receptor. So it blocks that. So the virus can't take hold to start with. That's one of them. It somehow blocks viral replication. It's not a direct antiviral, but it kind of tamps down the viral replication, and then it stops the cytokine storm. It's a massive anti-inflammatory. So I've had a couple patients that I put on ivermectin, and they called me and said, my knee pain is gone. Can I keep taking this long term? So we definitely have seen the anti-inflammatory effects across other diseases too.
That's exactly what I had a veterinarian tell me, is that it just simply stops the replication of the virus. And consequently, anything that you're doing beyond that will assist you, because the virus is not going to replicate like crazy.
Right. And like I said, it helps. So you can use it for prevention. you can use it early in disease and you can use it in late disease. So I think early on, it's the antiviral effect. Later on, it's that anti-inflammatory effect, which is why even when they get into the cytokine storm, it's still effective. And I had a patient in the ICU. So the alignment of my using ivermectin, having it available and having a patient that would qualify mm-hmm. for it, I only was able to treat two patients in the ICU. One of them went from 80% oxygen to room air in 3 days. And I don't think there's a doctor out there who has had that success. I've shared that story repeatedly. Another patient I had would definitely have been intubated and probably died. We got him through. He was desatting into the 80s for quite some time on a lot of oxygen. And now he's at home and on room air. And he's actually going to be talking at one of our events coming up in Kansas City on the 13th of November.
I mean, your stories echo what we're seeing happen all around the world, not just in the United States. And yet you can get in the most adamant arguments with people in the medical profession that's anecdotal. It just simply doesn't prove itself.
Yeah.
How can you continue to be oblivious to the truth?
So part of this, it goes to training in medical school, right? Because somehow the doctors have been brainwashed that I need a randomized controlled trial in order to practice medicine. That to me gives you permission to not think. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm looking at how we're using the medications, you have to really dig back to your first days in medical school. What's the physiology? What's the pharmacology? How is this drug working? You know, I'm using Pepcid not for the stomach issue, but because it's an antihistamine, and histamine is one of the cytokines. So, you know, that's, first of all, randomized controlled trials are one piece of evidence. It is not the totality of the evidence. You know, if I'm a doctor and I treat 500 patients X way and they all do well, that's evidence. It may not be published and it may not be in a journal and it may not be as credible as other forms. It's still evidence. And, you know, we have population-based studies. And to me, messy trials are actually the most important piece of data, right? Because when you're treating COVID, not everybody shows up on day two. And not everybody has the same body weight and not everybody gets the same treatment. So when you've got messy data, which is all comers that we treated, and we see population studies where the incidence drops like a rock in 2 weeks, that to me is the most meaningful information out there. And we have that in places like Uttar Pradesh, India.
You just nailed it. You are given permission not to think. That to me, I think, is my biggest frustration is just as human beings, we have the ability to be critical thinkers and it seems like we've surrendered it.
It really does. And, you know, the same thing with some other issues coming out right now. You know, we've got childhood vaccines coming out and I don't necessarily want to dig into that issue, but any disease where you have survival of 99.9997%, you can't have an intervention that statistically makes that better. It's not possible mathematically. And I'm not a statistics expert, but I can tell you that. So one would question the road we're going down with childhood vaccines for COVID as well.
What does the immune system do here's my question. How stressful is it on the immune system when you are given a vaccine?
So I think it's different for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind this vaccine or inoculation is a very narrow target, right? So we're teaching the body to make this spike protein, and then we're counting on the body to make antibodies to the spike protein. Now, it failed the three assumptions. The three assumptions were, number one, it stays in the arm. It does not do that. Number two, that the spike protein actually stays in the cell, and it just sticks up out of the cell so the antibodies can be exposed to it. We know that it doesn't do that. It's been found in circulation. And we assumed that the spike protein was benign. And now we know that that's actually what's highly toxic and causes a lot of the clotting problems and the inflammatory problems. So it's extremely stressful in the body, which is why we're seeing an incidence of death in the first 14 days after the vaccine in adults.
Yeah. And clearly it's leading to some serious heart damage and mm-hmm. What's the word? Myocarditis?
Myocarditis. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in the ICU, of course, I saw that, yeah, this is where you see it first, right? Before it gets up to the data, before it gets to the national level, it's what the people on the ground are seeing. And I looked around one day in my CVICU, cardiovascular ICU, and 5 of the 15 patients had been post-vaccination. And did that cause their issue? You know, I don't know. But nobody's looking at that. Not very many people are looking at that, I should say.
Yeah. Why aren't we looking at, why wouldn't we want to know this?
We do. We do. And we're pushing for that. You know,
we must. We absolutely must.
Correct. You know, I come from the surgical mindset, right? If I do an operation, I watch that patient for 30 days, longer really. But I want to see, do they have any adverse effects, you know? Like I did an appendectomy on a patient one day and he came back 2 days later with a stroke. Now my surgery didn't cause the stroke, but the inflammation mm-hmm. from the appendicitis likely did, right? So you look for those patterns and see what can I do better. And that's exactly what we should be doing with this experimental project that's been given to hundreds of millions of people. We should have been diligent about looking for that and being very transparent and very honest about that. And I think most people with common sense would say, the transparency is lacking and there's something not right.
You're much more kind about this jab for the kids than I am, because if you actually are a critical thinker, you look at the data, nobody under 30 should even consider taking a jab. I don't think if you're under 110, you should take a jab, but that's beside the point. If you just want to be a critical thinker and you're buying any level of the hogwash, if you look at the data, by giving anybody under 30 a jab, particularly 5 to 11, you're only going to cause harm with no net gain. Molly, this is just like the worst of the worst for me.
No, I agree. It's all risk benefit, right? And you have to have, if you don't have benefit, so I think we can make the argument in children, there's no benefit. There's almost zero mortality in children. I think there were 350 deaths in 2020, which is tragic. However, those children all had severe underlying conditions. The chance of a healthy child dying of COVID is zero. So now you get into, there's some teenagers that are overweight, that have some metabolic issues, and they may get in trouble. But so, like you said, if you have no benefit mm-hmm. from an intervention, all you buy is risk. And why would we do that for children? And that's short-term risk. We don't even know the long-term risk of a gene-based therapy.
Yeah, I hear horror stories, and I don't know how you document them, that it just does horrible things for the reproductive future of anybody who has had this jab.
And we don't know, right? We don't know. And so it shouldn't be deployed widely until we have that information.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have no fear of people coming at you for going public. How real is the animosity that you face simply by sharing what you have seen?
Yeah, I wouldn't say no fear, but I would just say I have such an ethical obligation to do the right thing and to do no harm. I mean, I take that oath of my profession very seriously. And I've always been concerned about the conflict of interest being an employed physician, right? Because he who controls the money has control. And so if you get paid by your employer, what your employer says is what your first obligation is if you're not stuck to the ethics of it. Mm-hmm. But when you see people doing harm, I'm the doctor that they talked to. I'm the one that sat with them when they had open heart surgery. And I'm the one who watched them cry tears, you know, as they are dealing with cardiac arrest and not an uncertain future. And when you have to do that enough, it motivates you to speak up because you don't want more people to go through that.
Dr. Molly James, my guest, we have one segment left. We will talk about the future of medicine. In every storm, I always am inclined to find a silver lining. So that is what we are going to explore when we get back with the last segment. Before I let you go, I want to remind you that if you're a cattleman, particularly in the Great Plains of America, between, let's say, St. Louis and Denver, then you might be interested in getting paid better for the quality of beef that you produce. In this case, I'm talking about tender beef. The Piedmontese breed does generate tender beef because the two copies of the myostatin gene are present. That means it is unregulated muscle growth, and that muscle is quite tender. But you, the producer, need to get paid. And so that's why we are talking about a $180 premium over market price. Get details from Marlon Will about how the certified Piedmontese system might be the right thing for you at www.lungcreekcattleco.com. Last segment of Rural Route. Dr. Molly James after this. Welcome back. Rural Route. Trent Luce. On a red shirt Friday, by the way, Dr. Molly James, my guest, joining us from just outside of St. Louis, Missouri. I told you the story of my brother. You also have a brother that has some history. Molly, do you want to tell us about your brother?
I do. So for anybody out there who's a family who's been going through it, I empathize with you so deeply because I just lived it. About 3 weeks ago, I went home to Iowa to launch my clinic in my hometown. My family all came down with COVID. So my brother has given me permission to share his story. Basically, we started treating him right away. Everybody had their meds and we started treatment. And they called me one morning and said he passed out. So I went home to his place. We evaluated him. He passed out again when I got there. And we ended up calling the ambulance and taking him to the local hospital. As a critical care physician sitting there with him, I actually got sick myself and was having some pretty good brain fog at that point. They didn't even run any labs. They didn't do an x-ray. They basically gave him a COVID test and a liter of fluid and sent us on our merry way. Mm. So the next morning what was happening is he would get up, he would, you know, go to the restroom, get lightheaded and basically lay down on the floor because he thought he would pass out. So about 6, 7, 8 days into it, he dropped his SATs to 80%. And in hindsight, I think what was happening is, and this is very common, this is a red flag symptom that I want to share with people. If you're feeling fine sitting down, but then when you get up to walk to another room and get lightheaded, what's happening is the oxygen level could be dropping, and then the heart slows down in response to that. And I think that's what was happening with my brother. So his SATs were 80. You know, I knew we had to do something. We headed to a different ER. And in that ER, they said I couldn't go back with him, and he refused to. He wasn't going to go in because he knows the story and he's heard it just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. So luckily, my contact with Dr. Fogarty and his colleague, Dr. Meyer, you know, we were in touch with them, and we put my brother in the car. We got some tanks of oxygen and we headed for Okoboji. And they gave him some supplements, some of the nitric and things that you're talking about, and they put him in the chamber. And after 10 treatments, he was off of oxygen completely.
So I'm guessing that you would happen to believe Dr. Fogarty is right, being a zealot for the hyperbaric chamber being good for human health.
I do. And I think specifically to COVID, I'm not an expert in it like he is. You know, I'm new to the scene. But I think what happens is when you get sick with COVID, you've got this inflammatory response. And mm-hmm. then it creates low oxygen. So you have this secondary inflammatory response from the hypoxemic injury to the tissues. And so you just compound and it snowballs. And what happens when you get in the hyperbaric chamber is you force oxygen into the tissues and you stop that process. And then you also you push oxygen into like the mitochondria. So you activate the body's ability. You recharge the immune system so it can work. You know, because I believe it's also stunned a little bit from the low oxygen level and what's going on. So you basically recharge it with the hyperbaric oxygen.
My assessment, just to touch on, I don't want to leave the hyperbaric chamber yet, but the silver lining in this storm is that finally people are beginning to realize that your immune system is ultimately the driver in human health. And if you don't have that immune system at the right level, you're going to be exposed to all types of bacteria and viruses and crud the rest of your life. How your immune system is sitting, how your gut bacteria is working, all of that is going to determine how you are going to respond from your body and standpoint, and whether you get sick or you don't get sick, it all comes back to the immune system. And I think, Molly, that maybe we finally taught people that how you feed your immune system, and not necessarily just in nutrition, but in all lifestyles, is going to determine how healthy you are for the rest of your life.
Yep. Excuse me. I would agree with that. And I've been saying since the beginning of the pandemic, I don't care what you do with masks and vaccines. At the end of the day, you're going to be exposed to this virus, and how your immune system responds is what's going to happen, right? Not that I don't care, but everyone's going to take a different path on that. No mask is going to be 100% protective. The vaccines clearly aren't 100% protective. Vitamin D levels above 50 are critical. So that's important. If you haven't checked it, it needs to be checked and it needs to be optimized. And I talk to people that are taking 1,000 to 2,000 units of vitamin D a day. That's not even worth the effort. I would take 5,000 to 10,000 a day unless you know you run over 100. So vitamin D is important. As you said, the gut health and the microbiome, making sure, you know, you're getting a probiotic, your gut, you know, eating fruits and vegetables to feed that microbiome. You know, that's really where we need to be focusing our efforts.
And pork lard.
Yes, of course.
Pork. you say yes, of course, because it's like a commercial. It's not a commercial. Pork lard is off the charts in available vitamin D. Cod liver oil is the only thing higher. Who would ever eat that? But you think of it. Just stop and think for a minute. Our grandparents ate everything. People ate lard sandwiches because they didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
And that generation, if you really look at human health, that generation is really healthier than what we have going on right now. So I think it's all pork lard.
I wouldn't say it's all pork lard, but I'll give you that it probably has very good vitamin D levels.
It's not all pork lard. Everything was different. They exercised more. They just worked harder. They sweat more. Dr. Nathan Bryan says that the biggest health challenge is that we just don't sweat, and how that affects our nitric oxide. And it's all the above. But I got to give pork lard a little bit of shout out here. I mean, it's a huge component of healthy living.
I would say this is probably the first time I've officially recommended that. So thank you for adding to my medical knowledge.
Could you give me a prescription for pork lard, please? You know, that's one other thing that we have to address, because you could be prescribing as a medical doctor Ivomec for your patients, and there are pharmacies that are just flat refusing to fill the prescription. How does that happen in today's world?
Well, that's a very good question, because to my understanding, there's pharmacy law on the books, and we don't have to make it up every time we have a new prescription that we don't like. So this is, you know, ivermectin has become a religion. It's not a religion. It's a medication. I don't need people to believe in it. I need them to prescribe it and fill it and take it. One of my patients, they denied the wrong person. I don't know if you've heard the story of Bill Salyer.
No.
He's gone public. He is a Marine that was very sick when I met him, and he shared his story publicly, and Walmart refused to fill his prescription. Because he was so sick, I actually called that Walmart pharmacist, and so I have a pretty interesting testimony to give, because this Marine is not having it. So there's now a federal lawsuit against Walmart for refusing to fill prescriptions that were prescribed by physicians.
Good. That needs to happen.
Yeah. And to me, the linchpin in it is they're starting to ask for a diagnosis code, right? Mm-hmm. So pharmacists have the right, and I've always worked well with pharmacists. So this is just the most odd spin of an odd time. They have an obligation if there's a toxic level, if the dose is too high or incorrect, or if there's a drug interaction, right? They have an obligation to raise that concern and check on that. And when those things have happened in the past, I've always been receptive, and so have other doctors, and appreciative that that's been caught. When they ask you for a diagnosis and they'll fill, like, hydroxychloroquine is okay to fill for rheumatoid arthritis, but it's not okay to fill for COVID, that is practicing medicine without a license, because it's not a dose problem. It's not an interaction problem. It's okay to give it for this, but not for that. I don't know that they have the training and ability. I don't know that that's in their scope of practice. Why we're making up pharmacy law on the fly, I don't know. And we need the attorneys general to speak up. We've had two now. We've had the Louisiana attorney general made a very strong statement in the state of Louisiana. The Nebraska attorney general, as a result of some of the work that one of my organizations I belong with have been doing, has issued a 60-page opinion that prescribing of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine off-label, which is what we're doing, and 90%+ of prescriptions probably are, is completely legal, and doctors will not be punished for that.
Yeah, maybe because I live in Nebraska, and I know Attorney General Peterson. I get a lot of people who have the wrong idea about what he said. What he said was that there will be no ramifications against any doctor who prescribes ivermectin. Mm-hmm. He did not say doctors should prescribe ivermectin. I just want to be clear about that, because I get people all around the world saying, well, man, that AG, Attorney General of Nebraska, sure got it right. Well, he's just saying the doctor's going to make the decision, and we're not going to hold them accountable to what they decide.
Yeah, it was a defensive position. I would have liked to have had a stronger statement on that, because I don't need someone to say I can't get in trouble for doing what I've done every day for 10 years. So on that, I felt it was a little bit weak, but I'm grateful it's out there, you know, and we've got people who are starting to understand the issue at least.
The only thing that was very positive about it is that they in the press release and the statement made it very clear that the information about ivermectin that's been presented is false. And I thought that was the positive side. Molly, we're in the final 2 minutes. What have we not addressed, or what do we need to most know from you today before we go forward?
Yeah, I think patients need to know, number one, early treatment is available, and you need to advocate for yourself. Okay. You need to find it. You need to be prepared, and you need to invest and fill the medications and have it in your cupboard. So the minute you get sick, you can start treatment. And that's number one. Number two, natural immunity is real, and nobody who has natural immunity needs to pursue a vaccine. So that's a key statement. And number three, as we've spoken about, there's no rational reason for the vaccinations in children. They're it's indefensible. So if people know those three things and act in those three things, they will protect themselves and they'll make wise decisions.
I have to ask you this before I say thank you. You do believe that there's a benefit to a jab later in life? What's your recommendation as a doctor?
So my general theory and my experience and the way I practice is that people who would be high risk for COVID are also high risk for the vaccine, because it exposes you to the same spike protein.
Perfect answer. We have success. Oh, what if people, your clinic, do you do things online, or what if they want to get hold of you?
Yep. So our temporary website, and I thought it was a little cheeky, is ivermectincan.com.
It's so, a lot cheeky.
yeah. Just in case there was any doubt to what I believed in or what I was doing. So ivermectincan.com. It will be changing very soon to the James Clinic, because you can imagine the censorship that's going with that. It's hard to find me unless you type it in exactly. So it's the James Clinic. You know, we're happy to take care of you. I've expanded my team now. There's two physicians and three nurse practitioners that are seeing patients. So more than happy to help.
And as I promised, we are circling back to where we started. Jesse James was all about taking on the establishment and people that were implementing their rule over the people. Dr. Molly James might be related. We've successfully journeyed down the road, connecting rural and urban America. Both of us remind you that all roads do lead to a rural route.